This is the AI Health Podcast, where we explore the ways in which AI will transform healthcare, biotech, and medicine through conversations with entrepreneurs, investors, and scientists.
Hey, I'm your co-host, Pranav Rajpurkar.
And I'm Adrielle Saporta.
And you're listening to the AI Health Podcast.
So this week in the US, we've been hearing a lot about the FDA because it's recently authorized coronavirus vaccines and tests. And I thought that we'd start today by talking a bit about the FDA and what it's in charge of.
Let's do it. What should we know about the FDA?
Okay, so brief history lesson. Back in the 19th and early 20th centuries, things were a little dicey when it came to food and drugs in the US. With the Industrial Revolution, the production of food and medicine became industrialized, and there was little regulation in place to make sure that manufacturers weren't cutting corners or taking advantage of consumers in some way. And so you had fraudsters selling patent medicines that did nothing to help consumers and even sometimes used morphine or cocaine to hook consumers instead of actually treating them. You had manufacturers using spices and additives to mask the taste of expired meat.
That's problematic.
Yeah. And at the turn of the 20th century, there was a big push to address these issues by activists, including millions of American women who were worried for their family's health and safety. And if our readers are familiar with Upton Sinclair, his famous expose, The Jungle, was published in 1906 and drew so much public attention to the unsanitary production of processed foods that same year, President Theodore Roosevelt signed the bill that created the agency that eventually became the FDA.
That's an incredible story. So could you describe for our listeners what exactly the FDA does?
Yeah, so the FDA's regulatory authority is really broad. The agency is charged with overseeing all things related to food, drugs, cosmetics, animal food, medical devices, biological goods. The FDA is responsible for ensuring that companies prove the safety and efficacy of their products, manufacture them properly, and also market them appropriately. And they can also recall products on the market if necessary for safety and other reasons.
And on this podcast, we'll hear the FDA come up quite a bit in conversations around new drugs, biologics, or medical devices.
Exactly. And maybe we should actually go over those three categories very quickly. When I say drugs, that can be anything from prescription drugs for humans and animals to over-the-counter drugs.
And we've talked already a bit on the show about new drugs needing to go through four phases of clinical trials before they can hit the market in the US. And it's the FDA that set up all of those rules and requires new drugs to go through those clinical trials.
Exactly. The FDA also creates incentives and gives tax credits to pharmaceutical companies that are developing what are called orphan drugs or treatments for rare diseases. Now, biologics are treatments made using tissue or blood. So that includes vaccines, insulin, stem cell therapies. We haven't talked too much on the show about biologics, but we definitely will. And then that brings us finally to medical devices,
which we have spoken about quite a bit.
Yeah. And medical devices can include everything from wood tongue depressors to pacemakers.
So to be clear, the FDA's job isn't to develop products or even test products, it's to review submissions and the results of independent lab and clinical testing to determine if a product is safe and effective.
Exactly. And the reason I wanted to spend time talking about the FDA is that if you're in the space, whether you're creating a product or investing in a product, the FDA will be absolutely critical to that product's success or failure. In the US, you cannot sell or market a product under the FDA's purview without their approval or clearance. The FDA essentially decides who competes in the market.
We're going to talk today about one of the FDA milestones for AI technologies in medicine. We'll talk about the first permitted marketing of a medical device to use artificial intelligence across any field of medicine.
Cool. So when did that happen and what task was it for?
This was back in April 2018, and for the task of detecting greater than a mild level of eye disease, diabetic retinopathy in adults who have diabetes. So diabetic retinopathy occurs when there are high levels of blood sugar leading to damage in the blood vessels of the retina in the eye, and it is the most common cause of vision loss among more than 30 million Americans living with diabetes and also the leading cause of blindness among working age adults.
And what was the technology that ultimately was developed to help with that?
This particular technology is called IDXDR. This uses an AI algorithm to analyze images of the eye taken with a retinal camera. And so this algorithm explicitly detects the signs or what are called biomarkers that are characteristic for diabetic retinopathy, which we're shortening to DR, including microaneurysms as an example, which can be seen as these tiny red dots within the eye, and other biomarkers. And now the outputs of these signs are then fused together into a disease level output using a separately trained machine learning algorithm. And the idea here is to develop these clinically inspired diagnostic algorithms with detectors for these specific biomarkers, because now you can trace why something might be called diabetic retinopathy by pointing to the existence of one or more of these explicit signs.
And do these features for detecting DR vary at all across categories like age or ethnicities?
That's a good question. Doctors managing DR are aware that although the incidence and the prevalence of DR vary across racial, ethnic, and age categories, the signs are constant across races and ethnicities. In other words, whether or not someone with diabetes showing multiple of these signs is Asian or non-Asian, for instance, does not affect whether the doctor will diagnose DR.
Got it. And so how does this technology play in the clinic?
So a doctor uploads these digital images of the patient's retinas to a cloud server on which the software is installed. Now, if the images are of sufficient quality, the software provides the doctor with one of two results. So one is saying more than mild diabetic retinopathy detected, refer to eye care professional, or the second, negative for more than mild diabetic retinopathy, rescreen in 12 months. Now, if a positive result is detected, patients should see an eye care provider for further diagnostic evaluation and possible treatment.
So it sounds like the device is making a diagnostic decision without needing any doctor to interpret the image or the results. Is that right?
That's a great point, and absolutely right. The autonomy of a medical AI system reflects this level of, or lack of, expert oversight of the clinical decision and clinical care. So we can talk about three different levels of autonomy in AI. We can talk about no autonomy, assistive, or autonomous. So in no autonomy, there's no AI that's providing a treatment, diagnosis, recommendation. Then we have assistive autonomy, in which we have an AI system that is assisting clinicians by giving them a diagnosis, but relying on physician interpretation of the said advice to then direct patient care. And then we have the third level, the autonomous level, where we have the AI that's directly providing the treatment or diagnosis without physician interpretation.
So IDXDR would be the autonomous level.
That's correct. IDXDR is the first device authorized for marketing that provides a screening decision without the need for a clinician to interpret the image or results, which makes it usable by healthcare providers who may not normally be involved in eye care.
Wow, that's a big deal.
Yeah, IDXDR was reviewed under the FDA's De Novo Premarket Review Pathway, which is a regulatory pathway for some low to moderate risk devices that are novel and for which there is no prior legally marketed device. And IDXDR was granted breakthrough device designation.
Oh, cool. So for our listeners, breakthrough device designation means that the FDA helped to expedite evidence generation and in general, just the agency's review of the device. And to qualify for this designation, this breakthrough device designation, a device must meet certain criteria and provide effective treatment or diagnosis of a life-threatening or irreversibly debilitating disease.
Right. So then this was in April 2018, and Digital Diagnostics, then called IDX, thus became the first company in any field of medicine to get FDA approval for autonomous AI.
Yeah, and the company was really one of the first to establish autonomous AI in the clinical setting. IDX was the first AI product that was approved to diagnose disease, which is a clinical call that was previously made only by human physicians. And now, actually, in August 2020, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, made a historic decision, which is to reimburse the use of autonomous AI in healthcare for the first time. And this milestone really should be applauded, as reimbursement is key to bringing autonomous AI into more communities and expanding its benefits to more patients.
So let's talk about how this reimbursement works.
Yeah, so Digital Diagnostics worked with the American Medical Association to create a CPT code for retinal imaging with autonomous AI. And then they got the CMS to propose a rule for coverage of that CPT code. And CPT codes are basically a system administered by the American Medical Association that identifies medical procedures. So each medical procedure is given its own unique 5-digit code that tells insurance companies what type of treatment was provided. And then the insurance companies use that CPT code to determine how they'll reimburse the provider for that service. And there are CPT codes for almost everything a licensed medical provider can do, and more are created each year. So, for example, the code 12002 may be used when a doctor stitches up a 1-inch cut on your arm.
So the CPT code was created for exactly the kind of procedure that IDX performs, and the CMS has proposed a rule to cover that CPT code.
Exactly. And this is a big deal because it would be the first time the CMS covers the use of autonomous AI in a primary care setting.
Wow. Well, I'm excited to chat with our guest, Dr. Michael Abramoff, scientist, practicing ophthalmologist, and entrepreneur. He is the founder and the executive chairman of Digital Diagnostics, which we've talked about, formerly known also as IDX Technologies.
Michael, welcome to the show.
I'd love to start out with asking you about how you got to found IDX, now called Digital Diagnostics, and you've spent a long amount of time on this, and you have really been pioneering the field in terms of AI for diabetic retinopathy. I'd love to just hear about how it got started.
I did a master in neural networks in 89, so you can see from my hair I'm older. And so I was sort of doing medical school at the same time when I was doing my residency and was seeing patients. It became obvious that maybe there's a better way of diagnosing these patients, and specifically for people with diabetes, the diabetic eye exam is usually important to prevent blindness. And there's two types of patients: some never go until it's too late, and they have serious damage that is irreversible vision loss. And there's the other very conscientious patients who never have anything wrong with them. And so my clinic was, even as a resident, partially filled up with that. And I thought there must be a better way where I have a computer essentially triaging these patients. And why don't we use neural networks or other machine learning approaches to solve this?
And which year was this?
96, 97. I had this naive idea. If you just do a publication, people say, "Wow, that's brilliant! Let's do it." And that's how you change medical practice. Well, that's not how you change medical practice. You know that, but I didn't know that. And so I decided to do a PhD in machine learning during my residency, which is not recommended either, especially if you two young children with your wife who's in residency for psychiatry. And it was a busy time. And so I did this PhD because right then there was really no one doing this. And I had no authority to say we can do this and let's get some funding or whatever. I mean, I was just a resident, right? And I had this master in neural networks. Did my PhD, started my fellowship, and then started realizing that we didn't have very good data, meaning objective, noise-free data. And so then you essentially never get beyond what the data tells you. And so even in the 80s, that was still a problem. And so by the time I wanted to do this, I realized, well, the big thing is enough data. And there was literally no digital data on fundus images. So I actually set up a telemedicine project that still exists in Holland called iCheck, where we're going to treat patients, but actually I need these images to build the AI so I can actually do it better. Again, still naively thinking, well, if I just do not one publication maybe, but hundreds of publications, all scientifically very strong studies, people say, "Wow, we need to do this." Never happened. And so started talking to people, and they said, well, you just need to do a patent, right? If you do a patent and Google or IBM, at the time IBM was way bigger than Google, will come in and do it for you. There's nothing you need to do, just do your patent. So I've now 17 patents or so, nothing happened, right?
So sorry, just to clarify, so they mean you do a patent and then Google or one of these big companies comes and...
Oh, they don't. No. That was my naivete.
That was the thinking. Just, okay.
Again, my thinking was, if you do really good science, everyone will say, wow, we need to do this. Let's do it. Let's change healthcare this way. Wrong. Then the next step was, well, let's do some IP. And now it's protected. And then people will say, well, there's actually a business model there. And we'll do all of that. You don't have to worry. Which is how actually... In pharma, it does work, right? You're a biochemist and you make some new, really cool molecule. And then actually, you know, Roche or Genentech will come in and license from you and start producing it and doing the trials. And you don't have to spend any effort. There's a really good system for that, which there was nothing. There was no ecosystem for AI.
And if I can just ask there, so is there something specific about software or AI that made it feel like, you know, this valley of death that exists for translation from a lab setting to an industry setting was not being connected? Or was this something that you saw as applying to all of medicine or larger branches of science that this translation didn't happen through publications and patenting?
In general, I see the valley of death as a moat, which is, you know, an advantage, competitive advantage, right? And so partially the valley of death exists because researchers are just really focused on doing cool science and competing, you know, on that, right? If you're a scientist, you compete with other scientists, and it's the really cool novel stuff that gets you grants because all the study sections are composed of the same, you know, buddies, right? But you never think, well, I shouldn't be too critical, but I don't see enough of thinking, well, what is actually needed for patients to improve patient outcomes? Many people do, but it's so seductive to focus on the cool science and the novelty rather than going back to, you know, patients like real world, right? And so I think that's where the value of that comes from, more than the VCs and the financing mechanisms are all there. I would rather say there's a death trap. There's not a valley of death. There's a death trap in the form of SBIRs, where I've seen so many people say, well, we have cool science, you know, is well intended, but what you see is starting these SBIR mills where people keep trying to find funding for the next round. And then so they develop never, you know, hearing back from the health system, well, this is a useful thing. No, I just keep getting SBIRs, right? I see a lot of people doing that. And for me, that's a death trap because you know, it's so scary to go beyond that and actually build, you know, start thinking about business models and what the market wants, right? And what the actual people who implement AI want. I think that's more of a problem than the value of death.
I'm curious if you think that part of this death trap is because it's really hard to put a product out into the clinical workflow in terms of regulation and making sure that we don't harm patients along the way. Do you think that's a part of this as well?
Oh yeah. No. I'm just saying, but pharma doesn't have. There's a very good pipeline, and in AI we creating that, right? So it doesn't exist because no one thought about it, because no one said, well, let's have a computer make a diagnosis. That is, whoa, you know, there was people saying, well, you need to raise money by going to wealthy donors, philanthropy. And you say, well, here's this cool Smiles model I have, and it's going to cure death, whatever. That's how you do philanthropy, right? And so, but it turns out I started talking to FDA in 2010. Well, what does it take to get an autonomous AI approved? And they didn't know, right? They've never done this. And so it turned out a lot of this is a bunch of paperwork. Like I have one slide, which I like to show, which is 6,000 pages of material we had to show to the FDA to get approval. And so you go to donors and say, well, we actually want to build a quality system to get ISO 34485 certified, which is what we had to do. They're not very excited. They want to say, here's a mouse model. Let's bring it to humans to cure death. Not here's a, you know, here's $10 million to build a bunch of paper mountains. I couldn't get them excited.
And can you maybe talk a little bit about how you even started these conversations with the FDA? In my mind, the FDA is this big institutional, scary, you know, how would you even get a foot in the door?
I talked to at conferences. There were usually there's FDA people watching what is going on. They're everywhere. They're watching everything you do. So if there is, well, I learned that later. I was literally 6 years into a meeting with FDA, and I was saying something, and he said, "Well, in a paper 5 years ago, you said the opposite." Whoa, we don't know. Okay, right?
Wow.
And so, okay, maybe. I changed my mind, okay? But they watch very carefully where, you know, there's burgeoning fields to see what's going on. They keep close watch. They're very involved, and they want to be. And they, you know, they're overwhelmed right now, A, because of COVID, and B, because of thousands of applications for AI, which is why, you know, we're trying to help them with this community. But in general, they want to make it work. But they are risk averse, which is expected. And so you can walk up to them and say, you know, this cool idea, and they will probably say, do a pre-submission. And now you get into the big money, right? Because one of the things that you need to realize, it's for any software, you know, at least ISO, and you need to build a quality system. And I assume you code yourself, but, you know, coding under ISO and a quality system is like, you know, 1% coding and 99% documentation and requirements and all these processes. That's, I think, rightfully so, a burden on really good quality software. And so I think, you know, we are right to have very high qualifications for good software that is used on patients. And you can see what gone wrong. I still use Ferguson as this example, actually, of, well, people say, well, we don't want black boxes because we don't know what's going on. And then people say, well, you can validate them. But this model was used for 20 years, made very bad predictions for mad cow disease, for other diseases, and he was off by a factor of 100 every time, and still people trusted that model until people started delving into the code. And so black box validation is not enough. You need to actually understand the code before you know whether something works or is safe. So I like to use it as an example of, hey, maybe black boxes is a problem here with AI. Back to software development, we literally spent 4 or 5 years with a existing prototype that worked really well to bring it, you know, into ISO certification.
And could you describe a little more on the ISO certification, what this means?
It's just part of a larger body of standards for a quality system. And what this means is that rather than say, well, I have this problem, let me code it that way, and then let's trial and error, see whether it works, and from time to time I discover bugs. Rather, you have a very deliberate process of, these are the risks for the system I want to build. You know, what can go wrong? Most at the output level, but then also at the modular level. So you actually go into the code and say, well, this subcomponent has this risk associated, and I want it to require this, and I assert that it works in this way. So you start at the, you know, the total system level risks and requirements, and then you go into subdividing that. And at the modular level, and ultimately, literally at the line of code level, you know why it's there. You can trace it. That's called traceability. Trace it all the way back to either a risk or a requirement. And so they audit you to see whether you're in compliance with, essentially, your documentation is in compliance with your own rules, right? I mean, I wouldn't delve, you know, dwell too much on it because it's literally thousands of hours, of course. But again, philanthropists do not get excited about this stuff.
Right.
Even though it's hugely important, and why so few people die of stuff in the US is because we have these very good systems.
Got it. So if I can zoom out for a little, and you've described some of the challenges now. Now in 2018, there's a pivotal moment in the development of AI technologies for medicine in the first autonomous point of care system that was de novo authorized by the FDA. Could you talk a little bit about this moment and what it means for the present and for the future of AI in medicine?
Well, it was huge because, again, we had CE approval in Europe for years. It meant nothing, right? It was self-certification. And no one looked at safety. And here we had to develop this entire system of ethics about autonomous AI to actually make this happen. So A, it was the crown on part of the work. And B, it was a great moment for medicine because why we're going to all this trouble, healthcare is too expensive. It should definitely try to be better than it can if we can. And, you know, this AI is better than me as a pretty experienced retina specialist. And most importantly, we need more equity in addressing inequalities, which is about access. you know, rather than me being this very special person you need to make an appointment with and it's, you know, 6 month wait time or whatever. No, you can get it around the corner in the Safeway, you know, which is a grocery store or in some primary care clinic where you are as a patient. But you want to be where the patient is so they get the easiest access. That improves outcomes, compliance, and being treated the way you should be treated. The problem with diabetes is that people are not having the diabetic eye exams that they need. And so everyone gets told you need to see an eye care specialist every year and it don't go, like 15% go. And we know it improves outcomes. And so if you are someone with diabetes, you get told, well, you need to see an eye care provider. We can put the AI in there and you can get, you know, examined immediately. It takes a few minutes and you have the diagnostic result. If you're normal, which is typically happening in like 80, 90% of cases, you're done. You can take care of your diabetes, but you don't have to worry about your eyes. If you're positive, now you need an eye care provider. Then you need a referral. But again, it was a great moment. It's like the Nobel Prize call, right? I got the call and so they called me, hey, you know, we're going to bring out a press release today that approved you. So, well, I think it was a great moment for medicine.
I'm curious if you, having gone through this process yourself, if you'd have advice for other entrepreneurs out there who know that they're going to have to face the FDA, they're going to have to get regulation. Are there things that you wish you had known beforehand that you would advise your earlier self?
Yeah, but you know, I had to create it all myself. And so, you know, now that the path is there, just follow the path, I would say. That's your best bet. And then realize that it will be tough. You will need a lot of money.
Yeah.
And you better think about that aspect. You know, we raised into about $70 million until now. And so it's a big endeavor. We needed at least $22 million just to get started.
Just a quick question on that front. In terms of FDA regulation, a lot of entrepreneurs think about the extended amount of time. Now, you got, having gone through it first, I imagine, took more time than it would take for those after. Could you describe a little bit on if someone were to start a company for, let's say, AI for doing something with retinal fundus photos, let's say a diagnostic decision, how long should they expect to take?
Depends where they are. So if you have a working prototype and it's not a black box, which, you know, we're reluctant about, and you understand what it does, which is not post hoc some heat map, it's actually understanding what the algorithm does. So let's say that you have that, you'll probably start to build your quality system, so to become ISO certified and all the other stuff and get audited, right? So you need to raise the money for that, and then probably you can, you know, just copy our trial in this case, and you go to the FDA and do a pre-submission. And you say, well, here's how we developed it. Here's the design. That's hundreds of pages, thousands of pages. And here's the trial we propose. And here's what the indications and the labeling we want. Because the only thing you ask from FDA is to have them allow you to make certain claims, right? So you can claim anything, but you need scientific evidence that they agree upon is valid enough for the safety, et cetera. But it shouldn't take long. I mean, you know, trial, maybe a year, FDA going back and forth without breakthrough, maybe another year. So it's only 6 years. But then there's no business model, right? Because, you know, you have FDA approval. You're, you know, okay, sure. And people say, well, that's nice. You can be proud of yourself. I'm not interested because how do I get paid for this, right?
I completely agree with you that I think taking the Uber approach in healthcare makes me a little worried, the sort of idea of bulldozing past regulation. And so I like hearing your optimism around working with the FDA and the pathways that they have available. I'd love to be able to move on to ethics. I know this is something that you've written a lot about how to build ethical autonomous systems. And if you could walk us through, I remember sort of a list of ethical risks in building autonomous systems, and we can kind of go through them one by one, or maybe you can pick some of your favorites, whatever approach you'd like to take. You tell me.
So you have this AI, like, you know, Pranav sketched, right? But that doesn't mean it fits really well into the clinic workflow and what people actually need and improving outcomes, right? So that's a bunch of requirements. And then there is the ethical aspect, which is really, why do we even allow a computer to make a diagnosis or make a decision? They have involvement of computers in healthcare by themselves. And so my worry started with, I don't want a backlash like we had in gene therapy, right? In gene therapy, people did some, you know, not very smart trials, very unethical trials, and people died, young people died. And it was just, everyone shut it down. They said, no more funding for this until you figure this out. It took 20 years. And so if we have that in AI, we lose all these advantages that finally we're having success, right? And that will kill it. And I don't want that because, again, cost saving. I don't want my kids to pay 100% of their income to healthcare, which is where it's going if we don't stop this. And so cost saving, better quality, better access. So how do we make sure that it's right? And does it actually improve patient outcomes? Show me evidence, right? That is what people worry about. Why are we paying for this?
So you've written about how you can show that these autonomous systems sort of work in a bubble, in a vacuum. But then once you actually put them in the clinical workflow, sometimes they don't actually improve patient outcomes in the way that you'd expect. Can you maybe describe for our audience some examples?
The Fenton example, right? So, you know, there's plenty of assistive AIs, which means you have a clinician and they made a medical decision aided by an AI that tells them, well, look carefully, maybe you need to look again at this lesion. And sure, that works. Liability is fully with the physician and a decision is made by them. And so what they did was go through FDA process and they compared the AI in isolation to a bunch of really expert radiologists. And it did really well on 200 women. It really diagnosed breast cancer really well. And so they said, oh, that's great. Let's FDA approve it. We came on the market, people are using it, but no one ever evaluated how it works in the actual workflow, which is not in isolation as an autonomous AI, but rather as an assistive AI, where you have this interaction of this very variable radiologist with the AI. And so what the brilliance of Fenton et al. Was that they said, well, let's look how the outcomes of women diagnosed by the radiologist with the AI compared to the radiologist alone. And I've run into two things when, you know, over the many years I've done this, which is A, doctors are perfect and AI is not, or AI is perfect and doctors are not. Both are wrong. AI is not perfect and doctors are not. And so the idea with the system was, yeah, of course the AI makes the doctor better. How can it be worse? But actually the outcomes for women diagnosed by the radiologist plus AI were worse than by the radiologist alone. And that shows that it's not enough to look at it in isolation in a laboratory setting. You need to evaluate it in the workflow, which is what you're referring to.
Now, I'm curious, going down this autonomous AI approach, a lot of people believe that the deployment of these algorithms will be in a way that assists medical doctors in medical decision making. And this is different than the route that you've gone with the autonomous AI algorithm. So in the autonomous deployment, the question then comes up again, is this replacing a physician in terms of making this diagnostic decision? And does that have implications for the number of jobs that will be available to physicians should everything, all medical diagnostic decisions made off of images, be automated this way?
Yeah, so my nickname is the Retinator, and so maybe you read about it. So the chair of ophthalmology at Hopkins read about my research in 2010 and did an editorial in the biggest ophthalmology journal, Ophthalmology Times, and I was trying to get tenure at the time, and he said, well, you're the Retinator, Revenge of the Machines. And somewhat jokingly, but somewhat seriously, he said, this is destroying jobs and it will lower the quality of care. And so, I've been through that. The answer is typically, it does not replace a physician because a physician is, you know, sort of a general AI, right? And this is very narrow. It's for a specific thing that we, either as a society or as a payer, decided this is worthwhile doing. It is narrow in that way. It is also really hard to do this for orphan diseases because if you have only a few cases, how do you train an AI that is at least partially machine learning? You need to optimize. And so, B, what you see in ophthalmology and why actually the American Academy of Ophthalmology has been a really strong supporter is because rather than trying to diagnose people who mostly have nothing wrong with them, you are finding the cases for an actual specialist becomes much better because there's much more to treat. And so what is nice is we have a second product now. The second one is dermatology, right? Same story. Primary care, you know, just isn't comfortable making this diagnosis, doesn't have the expertise in their mind. And so same for the retina. We make the diagnosis then with the AI. And then if it's abnormal, you go to the dermatologist to evaluate, maybe take a biopsy or treat or whatever. And so, you know, it's not taking jobs away. It's making sure that the highly paid specialists get the patients they actually benefit from their care.
So in your mind, autonomous AI can help triage patients in the healthcare system, but we still use our physicians for the normal care that we would expect. Is that fair?
Well, in a way, well, normal care, I'm not sure what you mean by that, but we optimize AI to do these narrow, you know, grunt tasks, and we optimize physicians to operate what they're best at with this listening to the patient, integrating all the history and everything else they know about into the treatment plan, right? It's more than normal. It's, you know, you shift to the more exciting part of the work.
Right. That's fair.
I'm curious hearing from you, from your perspective as a physician, now that these tasks are automated, does that mean less reimbursement and possibility for reimbursement for a physician's daily routine? And so even if it's not jobs that are being lost, would these reduce the amount of earnings a physician or a system or a clinic will be able to make?
Well, so that's not what you see, because we created, and that's part of the deal, right? The FDA was not the end of it. We had to create a CPT code, payment, all for autonomous AI had never been done. So that's probably my bigger achievement. But so there's a special CPT code specifically for autonomous AI doing the diabetic eye exam. So that is valued separately. On the other hand, the healthcare system is not a job program for doctors. It is to improve outcomes for patients, or at least it should be. And so if there's a way to have better patient outcomes, we should want that. If fewer people go blind because we do things a certain way rather than another way, I think that's something to be supported rather than to be criticized. But we need to do this right. We need to have the support of physicians. We need to make sure that they, you know, again, can do what they're actually, we want them to do, which is do the more difficult things, right? But where I see this going, and where the movement is to create specific CPT codes. And we can talk about what a CPT code means.
How did you get the CPT code? And maybe you can walk us through what a CPT code is.
Yeah, so let's start with what a CPT code is. So everything in medicine that you do has a number associated with it, you call the CPT code. These are managed and created by the CPT editorial panel, where all the physician organizations, mostly professional societies, patient organizations, as well as payers like CMS and private payers, are represented. And let's say that a new technology comes available. And so there's a whole debate, well, should this specific procedure have a new CPT code associated with it so we can measure how often it's used? And then we know that the payers will think about how to pay for this. And it's really central because both private payers and public payers like Medicare and Medicaid use this to determine you did the CPT code, you get that amount of money for it in a fee-for-based system. But even in value-based systems, the CPT code is still hugely important, interestingly. And so the CPT code is sort of the atom in process in healthcare. It's like the elementary particle that you need to have, okay? Because without it, there will be no payment. No one wants to meet with you to discuss a payment. Where's your CPT code? Well, yeah, we don't know. And so it took FDA approval. Before that, they didn't want to discuss it because it was the first autonomous AI. What do we do with this computer making diagnosis? So there was a long process where it was involving stakeholders in medicine, including patient organizations, physician organizations, and interfacing very directly why this is the right thing to do. Did we think of equity? Did we think of safety? All these things that is in the ethics paper were really important to get broad support, which is needed because everyone has their say at the CPT editorial panel meetings. And so I presented there, the American Academy of Ophthalmology presented there, all the primary care organizations presented there, and we discussed, and everyone realized this is the first time we're going to create a CPT code for a computer making a diagnosis. It was historic. Because they said, well, we realize now that there is a computer making a diagnosis and there will not a physician will be paid. And then you get into, well, so how do we pay for this? How do we value this? And that's yet another hurdle, right? But yeah, you asked about the CPT code. And so that took a lot of interaction working within the healthcare system again, because we didn't want to work without the healthcare system.
Did the commercial insurance companies have a big say in this as well?
They're all at the table.
They're all at the table. Got it. So all the big guys are at the table. And what year was this?
Last year. So 19.
Got it. Okay. So maybe just taking a quick step back and sort of the ethical topics that we covered. We talked about physicians not necessarily losing jobs, but that's an ethical concern. We talked about making sure that the quality of care is maintained when we're using these systems. We talked very, very briefly about AI exhibiting inappropriate racial or ethnic or sex biases. But that was one concern as well, correct?
Yeah, that was a huge concern from the beginning. And we realized very early on, well, we need to show that it works on all patients with diabetes in the US. So very quickly with the FDA, we decided, okay, we need to make this an endpoint or at least a metric. Okay, so we did that for the trial. But there was the separate issue of, well, how do we design the AI to avoid this from the bottom up? And one thing that was obvious for me is that, well, the brain solves this in a certain way. Human brain of clinicians has multiple detectors, let's say an oriented line. These are not independent detectors statistically. They're partially overlapping, partially dependent detectors. So that is how the brain does it. So why not do it the same way? And you can create these detectors mathematically, right? You know, the classical image analysis, or you can use machine learning. But the reason why that is so attractive, because these lesions that you detect are racially invariant. If I have a patient from Kenya or from Iceland or from Japan, if I see hemorrhages in the retina, for 150 years we have known, in combination with some other characteristics, that this is diabetic retinopathy. So why not use that? These are priors that have been developed over many, many years that have built in robustness, and we can talk about that, as well as all these ethnic invariants, sex invariants, etc. If you have this hemorrhage, you have the disease, otherwise you don't. Rather than just taking a bunch of images with unknown variants, and you hope that you capture all the variants that is in the population, and essentially, you know, associating pixels with diagnoses. If you look at other competitors, they actually have an earlier paper out where they did heat maps of post hoc, you know, saliency for the AI, and it showed that the mask, meaning the black area outside the retina, which is in the camera, not in the retina, was actually helping the neural network make the decision, meaning there's information in there that has nothing to do with the patient and probably with the location or the type of operator or how they took the images that is predicting whether they have disease or not. So there's just a number of disadvantages that you need to account for that is, to be honest, mathematically impossible to make sure and guarantee that you don't have that lack of variance, that you all avoid by using these priors. So why not use priors? Because we early on showed that the performance is the same, right? So if there is this giant gap between performance, or maybe it's a novel disease that no one knows what the biomarkers are for, sure, we need to do discovery and we may be able to find features that no human ever recognized, sure. But that is not the case in many diseases and probably not the lowest hanging fruit in AI in the first place. So for me, it was clear we need to build the AIs from the design to minimize ethnic or racial other bias, unwanted bias. And it was interesting that when I built a company early on, I told every developer, look, you need to realize that every time you code something, even a comparison, that may have implication for a patient. You need to be aware of that. Every time you code a line or even a character, think about what you do.
There's a lot to unpack here, but I want to thank you for going over so many different aspects of this development and this pipeline. I'd love to ask you a final question on your hope for the next 5 years in terms of where you see digital diagnostics at the end of these 5 years, the kinds of problems it's solving, the amount of patients it's covering.
Well, you know, hopefully it touches everyone by the end of the 5 years. There's so much opportunity and so much reason to do autonomous AI. Cost saving, better quality, better access. There's so much inequities in healthcare. Healthcare is too expensive. IT typically has not helped making healthcare more affordable. In fact, things like EHRs lower productivity rather than increase them. So IT doesn't have a good history in healthcare. With autonomous AI, we actually have a good chance of finally doing better there in terms of productivity. I expect many more AIs on the market for various reasons. I think partially it depends on development of sensors for different diseases. I hope to see some treatment AIs. I'm really excited about where we are, you know, in terms of using autonomous AI for treatment. I see surgical AI, autonomous surgery as a little bit farther ahead, to be honest. So I think many others will follow in our footsteps. We want that. We want to stay ahead, obviously, but we forge the path, use it, right? So I think it's going to be very exciting next 5 years.
Thank you so much for being on this podcast and for sharing all your thoughts with us. And that's all, folks. A big thank you to Dr. Michael Abramoff for talking to us today. And thank you for listening. We're your hosts, Pranav and Adriel. And until next time, stay safe and stay healthy.
The AI Health Podcast is produced and edited by Oishi Banerjee. Music by Ethan A. Chi. Many thanks to Emily Ross, my personal director and audio producer, to Ryan Hahn for his wisdom on the FDA, and to consulting producer Margaret Catcher. If you like what you just heard, let a friend know. Subscribe to the show and give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, follow us on Spotify, or connect with us on Twitter at AI Health Podcast.